倍。
Welcome to the Hotspot. I'm your host, Armand Desfouliarjamandi. Today we have a special Q&A style episode where we cover a bunch of hot topics, including HIP-19, hotspot shipping delays, proof of coverage, rewards distribution, Amazon Sidewalk, and a bunch of other things. I'm joined by my guest, Steve Sellers. Steve is brand new to Helium. He works in the tech industry. He found out about Helium recently, and he's intrigued by the project. So he eagerly searched for someone to ask questions to so he could solidify his understanding of various aspects of Helium. So I was happy to sit down with Steve and answer his questions to the best of my ability. I think he asked really good questions, and I hope all of you will be able to benefit from my thorough explanations of topics that are often points of confusion for newcomers and are asked about in the Helium community every single day.
Steve, welcome to the show.
Hey, Armin. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for being here. I've really been looking forward to having sort of more of an informal chat with not any specific subject in mind, but sort of just a general Q&A coming from someone who is recently introduced to Helium and just wants to know more. And it seems like that's you.
That's me. I read about it in some analytics type journals, and I'm coming out with a beginner's mindset, having been a long time enthusiast in the space. So this project really struck a chord with me, and I'm trying to wrap my head around all the aspects. So let's get into it.
Amazing. Well, yeah, let's start with your background. What led you to Helium, and what is your background? You said you're in the space, so I'd love to know more about that.
Yeah, I live in the Bay Area, work for one of the major tech companies in the Bay Area. I work on hardware. I'm a hardware engineer. I work with the telecom industry, and so I'm very familiar with the big telcos and hardware as well. So I first heard about this project, and actually the Messari, they had this kind of year in review thesis journal publication, and it got a few mentions, and I dug a little bit deeper into this Helium project, and I uncover it and I go, oh man, this looks cool. I can play with hardware. I can install antennas. I can kind of stick it to the big telcos by having my own decentralized network. Oh, this is awesome. I got to get into it. So that's what leads me here. I've been on a sprint. This kind of has grabbed my attention like no other. And I'm trying to digest all the content I can find, wrap my head around all the concepts, and kind of explore ideas for implementing miners, nodes in the future. I got a couple ideas, and I need some hardware. I need some more understanding before I can bring it to reality.
Wow, it seems like you're almost the like ideal person to be involved in the Helium network. You're in the industry, hate the big telcos, have the experience, want to deploy hardware on the, I'm assuming you're interested in the end device side of things as well as the miner side of things.
Right. There's the hardware aspect, the antennas, which I think is really cool. And then there's the whole mining and cloud mining, all these different variations. But the incentive model is incredible for this because, you know, I'm familiar with telecommunications. They spend a lot of money to build out their networks, provide coverage. And here the blockchain adds this element to create the incentive model such that people do it themselves. And
right.
And they're looking for edges. They're looking for ways that they can have the right coverage in the right places. And, you know, they get rewarded for it through the blockchain mechanism.
I think I come from a sort of similar place where I just found the incentive mechanism so interesting, sort of thought, you know, after reading a little bit about it, like, how could this not work? You know, how could this not blow up and cause this network to be built? And of course, we're seeing that it has caused that. I think I got involved when there were maybe 2,000 hotspots on the network. I think that was the point where I'd been tracking the project for months and I was like, this is a time to buy. And of course, now we've got... So much more like great coverage of the project. And Messari, you said great research portal. They have a lot of good insights. I think I actually read a specific blog post or letter that you were talking about. I think they highlighted, what is it, three assets?
Yeah, there was a couple other ones that bridge the space between blockchain and hardware realm. Yeah.
Yeah.
This one I think was kind of highlighted as covering the most ground, the most progress. Most promising. It's interesting. You say there's 2,000 nodes. I think there's 14,000 nodes now, but it's, you know, I live in the hardware realm. Like I've spent more time than I care to talk about in China, building hardware. And I know how difficult that is. And to bring the hardware to market to, you know, tens of thousands of people, quite an undertaking, quite an accomplishment. I think every batch that comes on gets sold out pretty quickly. And, you know, there's more demand than there is supply right now.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, we're certainly supply limited. And if you look in the community chat, like the hottest topic right now is, it's called HIP-19, which is basically bringing third-party manufacturers on board. And have you read about that at all?
Yeah, HIP-19. Yeah. It's interesting. And so I know they did away with the DIY key sort of model. And now that's sort of moving towards, maybe they have like vetted manufacturers who are kind of given the specific keys and they can deploy it on their hardware. It probably strikes the right balance between production volume and I guess network safety.
Yeah, let's dive into that a bit, because I think that's a really interesting topic and I want to lay it out clearly for people to sort of just understand the timeline. So at the beginning of the network, Helium was the hardware manufacturer, the software developer, the everything, right? There was no network. They needed to build everything from scratch. They worked with Rack, which is a Chinese company, to build the first hotspots. Actually, I believe Rack assembled the first hotspots, but they were designed by Helium hardware engineers. And then they had a second revision, also designed and sold by Helium. And those sold anywhere from $500 at the beginning to, I think the cheapest point they ever got to was $350 per unit. Helium eventually, you know, decided that it was just not worth it to continue producing these small batches. So I think the first batch was 3,000 and the next batch was 10,000. The cost was simply too high. And maybe you can speak more to, you know, hardware and batch manufacturing. But my understanding is that, you know, doing small batches of unique items is a tough thing and expensive to do.
Oh yeah. Hardware is, you don't want to accidentally reproduce the same mistake 10,000 times. But you get economies of scale if you have more volume. So there's always a trade-off. Your quality is more consistent with higher volumes, but there's a greater risk to doing something wrong over and over again. So, oh yeah, know very well that space.
Yeah, and I think Helium had the same sort of insight that you just spoke to, which is we're not gonna be able to do this cost effectively and with, you know, the quality that we want, and, you know, and take on the entire support burden and also build all the software and everything. You know, you as a company, you have just limited funding. And at the same time, you know, they want to work towards the goal to make the network decentralized, because, you know, what is it if it's not decentralized? It's just another, it might as well be, you know, just some web app with a SQL database, right? Mm-hmm. So the strategy for that was to stop manufacturing their own hotspots and bring on third-party manufacturers. And the first and most obvious one to bring on was Rack themselves, because they had manufactured LoRa equipment even before Helium got into the game. And they already had a few LoRa gateway products. And the one that eventually became the Rack miner, I believe, is called the WizGate. So it's a sort of modified version of that. So the question right now is, how do we get from this deal with Rack, where basically Rack is currently the exclusive hardware manufacturer, and not for, you know, not for any reason of exclusivity or like they're cutting some sort of backroom deal or something like that. It's just like these guys had worked with Helium. They knew software. They knew the process. They had made the concentrator chip themselves, and you know, they were ready to go and just build a ton of these units very quickly. So Helium chose them as a strategic partner to handle all of that. And then Calchip is the distributor. And this allowed Helium to sort of take that hardware load off of themselves. So now we're in an interesting position where Rack is the sole manufacturer and seller of hotspots. And as you said, there's crazy demand. And we're looking towards HIP-19 and how do we bring more manufacturers on board in a safe way? Because there's this sort of eventual decentralization with Helium, right? Where you mentioned the DIY keys earlier. The DIY program was something where basically, the end goal was that anyone could bring their own hardware and add it as a miner, a gateway on the Helium network. But there are problems with this. And the main problem with this is protecting proof of coverage, which is a very hard thing to do. You know, there's only so many verifications you can do with radio waves. So to be able to trust arbitrary hardware is just not an easy proposition. And so the DIY program, there were a few hundred called alpha codes given out. And basically this enabled people to transform their own hardware into helium compatible miners and add them to the blockchain. And so there are a few hundred of these out there right now. But that was an alpha program. It's been stopped and I don't see it coming back anytime soon. And so now, you know, the ultimate centralized approach would just be helium manufactures and sells everything. And the ultimate decentralized approach would be that anyone can add any hardware to the network arbitrarily, right? And so the middle approach that is being explored right now is how do we create standards for hardware that's secure enough, hard enough to hack and create virtual machine cheat nets with, but also, you know, allows more manufacturers to come on board, allows us to have standards around things like key issuance, right? How many hotspots are these manufacturers allowed to make before they're given unlimited license to just, you know, make as many as they want? And, you know, how can we hold them accountable? What happens if a manufacturer ends up creating cheat nets themselves, you know, doing malicious things with their keys? So a lot of nuance, a lot of depth to this discussion, but that's kind of where we're at right now in terms of getting more hardware on board.
Yeah, it's a complex problem, but I'm, you know, I'm looking forward to the kind of the next batch coming online in the spring from Rack. And that's a good intermediate point that can kind of fill the demand for a little while. So
right.
I'll be eagerly paying attention to how the HIP 19 evolves and how the new production model comes to life.
Yeah, they're doing a V2 now. I'll take this time as well to speak to sort of what happened with Rack and why they said over and over, we're shipping in a few weeks, you know, we're shipping next week, we're shipping tomorrow. And then when tomorrow came, it's like, hey, this thing is delayed for 2 months. Not an easy decision on the part of Rack and Calchip, but it is due to HIP-19 and the rapid progress that's being made there. So essentially the problem is that these V1 Rack miners that have been shipping have their swarm key. So swarm key is basically what allows you to connect to the blockchain and submit proof of coverage requests, right? It allows you to basically participate and be rewarded. And every hotspot has a swarm key. In the original Helium hotspots, there's an ECC module, which is basically a secure element where that swarm key is stored. So it's very hard to remove that private key and sort of take it into your own virtualized environment. But with the Rack miners, the swarm key is just on an SD card. As the Rack miners were delivered, I believe 3,000 of them were delivered. It was evident that people could take them and make these essentially virtual cheat nets, which had fake RF activity and sort of perfect performance that would allow them to get fake proof of coverage rewards. And so Rack, they could have shipped. So I think they had 10,000 more to go with that same SD card design, and they could have shipped those. But when they saw the standards of HIP-19 and the ECC chip requirement coming together, they decided to claw back everything at the last second and essentially say, hey, we're going to rework these all and put the ECC chip in and make it harder to extract the swarm key. And a lot of people were understandably upset because that meant, you know, their shipments weren't going to be coming anytime soon.
That's an interesting move. For Rack, because kind of they're trading short-term interest for long-term sort of success. They could have potentially made that choice to, hey, screw it, ship them. But they decided to, you know, for the long-term benefit of the project, make a change. I'm not sure if that's how it actually played out, but maybe.
Well, it seems to me that that's how it's played out. I haven't seen anything from Rack or Calchip that suggests otherwise. And, you know, I applaud the move personally. I was the first person probably not reading the room very well, like right after the email went out to go in the Calchip channel and, you know, congratulate them on the move. But, and of course, like within that same hour, like a million angry people came in and were like, what the heck? This is ridiculous. But I think they did the right thing. I think it's really important for the long-term health of the network that the swarm keys are protected and sort of hardware can be trusted. Like, this is really important. I mean, until the network is huge and has coverage almost everywhere, we're going to need to do things to protect proof of coverage because it's the most vulnerable part of the network. And this goes a really, really long way towards that goal.
I mean, maybe that's a good segue to kind of digesting some of the major phrases I hear in this project. Proof of coverage, number one. I have a concept of it, but I'd be curious your explanation. What's your tried and true explanation for proof of coverage?
So proof of coverage is basically a mechanism for proving that your hotspot is where it says it is. And not only that, but that you're providing wide coverage. It used to be more complicated, but thanks to HIP 15 and HIP 17, which were recently implemented, it's a lot easier to explain now. Basically what proof of coverage is every so many blocks, I believe it's 240 blocks right now, your hotspot is allowed to construct the challenge. And that challenge is going to be sent to another hotspot that's nowhere near your geographic location. So, you know, if I'm in California, I can challenge a hotspot in Krakow, right? It could be anywhere. That challenge is received. And then the receiving hotspot does what's called a beacon, which is basically they send out a radio signal, and any other hotspots in the vicinity that pick it up will report they witnessed that signal. What that essentially shows is that other hotspots in the area can see that this hotspot is transmitting a signal, and therefore the hotspot is proving itself to be in the same location as these other hotspots. That is sort of the basic overview of how it works.
So proof of coverage ensures that you are geographically located where you say you are. I guess because GPS signals can't be trusted, those can be spoofed.
Yes, exactly. So there was a few month trial of using GPS location to sort of prove that you were where you were. And the way that worked was that if your hotspot was asserted in a place that did not match the inbuilt GPS coordinate, then you would not be able to earn, essentially. It would be called a bad assertion. It turned out pretty quickly that adding this capability after hotspots had already been deployed was controversial and detrimental, because a lot of people simply just did not remember to update their hotspot's location when they moved them, for example. So hotspot that was providing legitimate coverage, but getting a bad GPS signal, suddenly was getting no rewards. And similarly, a lot of hotspots that were in legitimate locations could send LoRa packets to other hotspots and receive LoRa packets from other hotspots, but could not get a GPS signal fix. This is because GPS requires line of sight to the satellites. If you're in a concrete building, you're just not going to get a GPS fix. If you're in almost any building, it's very hard to get an accurate GPS fix. And thirdly, GPS is easily spoofed. If you are able to get into the device, you could change the GPS coordinates that it sends over the peer-to-peer network. There's nothing about GPS that actually proves anything, unless you're sure that you can trust the GPS hardware. But, you know, that gets into a whole other topic of like creating highly secure gateways where you can trust every piece of hardware and software. HIP 22, if anyone wants to read into that.
How does the block? Okay, so the blockchain creates this incentive structure. How is that coupled with the proof of coverage? There's a sequence of events and then you're rewarded. So how does that come about?
Well, there are multiple rewards in the system. There's proof of coverage rewards, there's data transfer rewards, and there's consensus rewards. And then category four is security token rewards, which I'll talk about separately. Let's break down proof of coverage. Most of the proof of coverage rewards go to witnessing. That means that if you're able to see other hotspots beacon, you will gain a share of each reward that you're able to see. And what this essentially means is that if you're in a city environment, and you're able to get a position for your hotspot that's like far above the city on a very clear view, and you're able to see the whole city, you'll be able to receive signals from a lot of hotspots, and you'll be rewarded a lot for that. The point is that you want to align the reward incentive with actual coverage, right? Sort of by definition, if you're able to receive signals from a lot of other hotspots, your receive capability is huge. And that means you're providing wide coverage. And it's important to note that in LoRaWAN, which is what the Helium network is built on, receiving is the most important thing, because that's what 99% of the packets are, right? They're just like one-way pings. Being able to send a downlink is important too, but it's far, far less important than being able to receive. So receiving is rewarded the most. The second most rewarded thing is transmitting a signal and being seen. And you get rewarded more based on how many hotspots see you. If at least four hotspots see you, you're going to be receiving almost the maximum amount of reward that you can receive for that proof of coverage. But if less than four see you, you're going to receive a lesser amount, because you're not quite proving yourself to provide as much coverage. And then the third breakdown there is the challenger themselves, which it's not useless, but it's just like, it provides very little value, but is also essential. And that's just literally constructing the proof of coverage challenge and sending it over the peer-to-peer network to someone else who will then receive and broadcast it. So that's like a very, very small percentage. All the proof of coverage rewards make up the vast majority of all the rewards in the network. The key to understanding how data transfer and security and all these other things play in is to understand what's fixed and what's sort of variable. On the website, there's a chart and it kind of shows like proof of coverage making up the majority of things, but then data transfer kind of takes over and eventually data transfer is everything. But this isn't exactly quite true. So as of HIP 10, basically there's two parts of the equation that are fixed. The security tokens. So the security tokens are basically things that are held by investors and by Helium Inc. I believe the Decentralized Wireless Alliance now holds some that basically entitle them to, I believe it's now 34% of all the ongoing coins mined. And this reduces by 1% per year. The other fixed part is the consensus group rewards at 6% of all the rewards on an ongoing basis. So these two things are fixed. They just never change. They make it 40%. Data transfer. So data transfer has a cap of how much it can take up, but it only takes up as much as is appropriate for data that's actually going through the network. So let me make that a lot clearer with an example. So
okay.
Like as of now, let's say data transfer is allowed up to 32.5%. What that means is in a given month, day, epoch, epoch is the smallest unit that you can split this up into for rewards, because that's like when rewards are calculated. But no matter if you split it up by epoch, by day, by month, by year, it's all the percentages are going to be the same. Every epoch, if let's just say there's 100 megabytes of data transfer on the network, and you know, according to the DC price, that causes a cost of $100 to be incurred. And let's say HNT is $1. In that epoch, 100 HNT will be allocated to providing data transfer rewards to the hotspots that transferred data in proportion to how much each one transferred relative to all the other ones in the epoch. What this essentially means is if you transmit one packet and that packet was the smallest size, which is worth one data credit, you're going to get one data credit worth of HNT back. So if no data is transferred in an epoch, all the rewards that could have gone to data transfer are all just going to go to proof of coverage. And so proof of coverage is a sliding scale, but it essentially becomes a scenario where proof of coverage is the vast majority of rewards. Data transfer can eat into proof of coverage if data transfer grows, which, you know, that's the ultimate goal of the network, is to be transmitting the actual packets.
Right.
But until then, proof of coverage gets the vast majority of rewards. And this is a good thing because proof of coverage allows miners to be rewarded for their coverage and reinvest in growing the network. So yeah, that's sort of the breakdown.
I see like a shifting incentive structure depending on, I guess, the maturity of the network. Right now it's like build, 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 coverage, coverage. You know, you've got to talk to four hotspots as best at a minimum. But then maybe when it's mature, you might optimize for like, you want to have coverage where the data is being consumed. It's not always going to be consumed in the suburbs or in your apartment or nearby, maybe in like different locations. So as it seems like, you know, I read the Explorer, it looks like, you know, tons of proof of coverage rewards, but the amount of data transfers is relatively little. So the amount of like LoRaWAN packets being transmitted seems relatively little at this point in time, maybe just because it's kind of young, right?
Yeah, I mean, you said it exactly right. The ultimate goal is to transmit data over the network, but we need a network first. And that's the whole point of proof of coverage. And just as you said, right, in the long, long-term view of things, the network is ubiquitous. Proof of coverage can go away because the marketplace essentially becomes a supply and demand marketplace for network data transfer. You're going to want to deploy hotspots in busy locations because you can pick up the packets and you can get paid for those packets. Like that's really the ultimate goal here. And proof of coverage is simply a vehicle to get to that ultimate goal.
That's very cool. So you kind of have broad, maybe not the best coverage, but it's broad and ubiquitous, and then slowly concentrated pockets pick up where the data is actually consumed, better coverage in those concentrated pockets. That's very cool.
Exactly. So we just have to keep the ship afloat, make sure proof of coverage is valid and the rewards are going to legitimate hotspots, because that's how the network succeeds and grows. Right. That's like the single most important thing right now. once proof of coverage is gone, I'm not going to say it will be gone anytime soon, but hypothetically, if the network is so ubiquitous, proof of coverage can just go away, and then all the issues about trust just disappear, right? You can have any device come onto the network, because as long as the device is transmitting packets, someone has to have paid for those packets in order for them to be transmitted in the first place. So that's sort of the beautiful, simple, like most decentralized future of a very mature Helium network.
That's very cool. Yeah, thank you for the explanation. I think it lays it out in a more clear narrative than I've seen so far. I guess getting to a little more to the nuts and bolts, there's the mining aspect. And I've seen there's mining on device and cloud mining. What's the difference?
So mining on device essentially means that the device has a copy of the ledger in some sort of way. And Helium is really unique in this way. In other networks, you'll have, like in Bitcoin, you'll have the miners, which are like super high powered ASICs at this point. You know, some proof of stake networks, there'll be machines on AWS. But the Helium team has done something amazing and also crazy, which is they fit all the blockchain activity onto these Raspberry Pi devices. I mean, this is just insane. Like these things have like a gigabyte of RAM, if that, and you know, like 32 or 64 gigabytes of storage. So yeah, every single blockchain activity currently happens on the hotspots. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, that is. You know, I've run like Bitcoin full nodes, and over time it takes so long to synchronize. It's a huge data hog, and you just kind of extrapolate, and you're like, there's no way anything but like a whole, like a server rack can handle a full node in the future.
For sure. Helium team has done some really interesting things to sort of overcome that limitation. Like for example, the miners actually don't store all the historical blocks. They just store a flattened view. Basically, you know, what is each account at this point in time of the ledger, so that they can essentially just validate new transactions based on the current state of the network and then throw out all the old ones as not to use up too much disk space. So they're simultaneously not full nodes, but also capable of doing all the verification that you would expect from a full node.
Is that a long-term sustainable path, or does it have to move to an AWS server?
It is absolutely not sustainable.
Okay.
It's. I think someone asked in the Discord the other day, you know, currently the lever that's being used to sort of scale this more as more hotspots come online is increase the challenge interval. So, you know, before, I believe it started at every 30 blocks, each hotspot could construct a challenge every 30 blocks. And then they doubled it to 60 and then to 120 and 240. And each time you double it, you essentially have the amount of transactions that the network has to process.
Okay.
So the TPS, as some people like to call it, get fancy. It's not sustainable. I think Amir said on Discord just recently, like someone asked like, hey, you know, at what point does this get unsustainable? And he said, you were there. And and he's not wrong. I mean, you can see sort of spikes in block times. I think the biggest blockchain issue has just been over and over spiking block times. And it always gets fixed, but you know, there's tons of engineer hours wasted just like optimizing this blockchain to run on Raspberry Pis. Huge effort underway right now to move everything over to cloud miners, which you asked about. It's essentially the same software, just as you said, running in AWS. So much beefier machine, can store the full ledger, can validate many, many more transactions per second, has more than a gigabyte of RAM. You know, there's basic things that you would want when you're, you know, looking to deploy a high performance blockchain.
That's good to hear. And it's like, I know that there's trade-offs in like bandwidth requirements, for instance. Like you talk about having a node and you want to put nodes at your friend's house. You don't want to blow out their bandwidth or something. You want to be cognizant of that. Maybe you want to get creative running on like a cellular line, and those are all data capped. So it seems like the cloud mining is the path towards reducing the amount of bandwidth needed from the individual node.
The nodes don't actually really use that much bandwidth even now, roughly 5 kilobytes per second on a continuous basis. But you bring a good point that there are so many different types of connectivity in this network that to have the consensus group running on these Raspberry Pis is a lot of the slow block times are just due to like, you know, a couple of the consensus group members, as you said, they're like backhauled by 3G or something. And you know, all of the network's transactions are being partially processed and over this 3G connection with like 2000 milliseconds latency, and just like intermittent in and out coverage. And frankly, it's another testament to like the choices that the Helium team has made in terms of choosing the Honey Badger BFT consensus protocol. Like the fact that blocks can even be validated and produced given that sort of scenario is just insane. Like the fact that the network doesn't just fall over is a miracle. So right, that speaks to right. the strength of the consensus algorithm.
That is interesting. It's able to handle the nice connections and then the slow pokes.
Many slow pokes out there.
Yeah. I guess maybe returning to how do you've got your hands on some hardware and you want to make the best out of it. It sounds like the number one thing to optimize for is having visibility to four other nodes. But people are, you know, they're putting them in their houses as kind of the suburbs. Maybe they don't have that. In those constraints, if you can't change your location, what can you do?
It's going to be tough. If you can't change your location and you can't afford to deploy more hotspots on your own, you're not going to earn much. Okay. And that's sort of by design. Like if you can't prove that you're covering somewhere, there's just no reason to reward you. And it's unfortunate because, you know, lone wolves, as we like to call them, or hotspots that have no other hotspots to talk to, are arguably some of the most important ones because they're creating the most brand new coverage, right? Optimization, I mean, there are many ways you can go about it. I think like location and visibility is really 90% of it. You can have the stock antenna, and if you're at the top of the, you know, Sears Tower in Chicago, you're going to be covering half the city. I think an important thing to note about like how hotspots are rewarded, you ideally want to be able to see at least four so you can maximize your reward for transmitting. But as far as receiving is concerned, you just want to be able to see as many hotspots as possible, because each time one of them transmits, you can witness it and you can grab a little bit of that reward.
Got it.
And that's how you really multiply your earnings, is just by being able to see as many hotspots as possible. And this is only true as of, you know, a couple of days ago, since HIP 15 was launched, which was, I think, a massive, massive improvement to the way things are and how things are rewarded. And another factor now, thanks to HIP 17, is density, right? So if you're in a really dense area, before every area was treated exactly the same, but now let's say you're in the northeast area of San Francisco, where there are multiple blocks that have five hotspots on them, your rewards are going to be scaled down incredibly low. Like you're transmitting reward will be like 5% of some other person's reward in a less dense area. So this is sort of to incentivize spreading out. So I guess in order of optimization, like the best thing to do, get a better location, number one, get a better antenna, number two, which can interact with number one, in the sense that getting a better antenna is often mostly a good idea because it will allow you to put the antenna in an external location, not because it has like higher gain. Like certainly higher gain antennas can increase your reach, but really, like if you're to double your antenna strength and leave it on a shelf with metal, you know, in your bedroom, that's going to be like five times less worthwhile than just like moving it to the window. It's so location first, I'd say, far above everything else, then antenna. Backhaul, also important. I've seen really big earnings drops just from people having like a poor Wi-Fi connection in that area of the house where they have the hotspot. And it's like really hard to know this. If you really insist on backhauling your hotspot with Wi-Fi, really important that you speed test. And don't speed test in the same room. You want to speed test. You want to put your phone in the spot where the hotspot is going to be, because you never know like what the materials around it, how that's going to affect the signal. Yeah. And remember that your hotspot does not have as strong of a Wi-Fi receiver as your phone does. So if your phone can get a signal in an area of the house, your hotspot might not get as strong of a signal. And this can cause you to miss challenges, not report your witnesses in time. Like this can really hurt your earnings.
So this is a question I'm exploring in my own mind and doing a lot of research on. Because to me, to give you the most optimized, you know, number one, which is location, like to me, it's cellular backhaul. And how can you have an LTE signal? And then that gives you so much flexibility in your location. Because then you can hang it on poles, you can put it willy-nilly all over town if you can get people to sign up to to holding onto it or whatever. But what are, I don't know, what are the pitfalls with the cellular backhaul? Are people doing it? Is it common? Is it smart? Is it bad for the network? I'm curious there.
People are doing it. It's becoming increasingly more common as people experiment and become comfortable with it, especially some of the larger deployers. You know, once they do a couple of prototypes and they find out that it works, then they get more confident in, you know, which cellular hardware they're using and whatnot. I know that one of the new hotspot manufacturers that's applying under HIP19 is going to be building a model with LTE built in. So that's going to be huge.
Oh, that's awesome.
But it works. It really does work. And the reason it works is because, as I said before, it only takes about 5 kilobytes per second to serve as a hotspot. And other than that, like the only thing you're going to really need to worry about is the software updates over the air, which I don't know exactly what size those are, but, you know, hundreds of megabytes at the most.
Okay.
So it works. Again, same thing with the Wi-Fi, though. You could have gigabit connection at home and your signal's poor. Doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
It really, consistency is so much more important for a cellular or any wireless signal than bandwidth is. And I can attest, I've used a little 3G, like MiFi type hotspot thing to backhaul a hotspot just for fun, just to test.
Yeah.
It works. You can do it.
So what about physical access? Because this is another question in my mind. If people are, they're like climbing poles and putting them up there, you can't exactly access these things down the line whenever you need to. You can't walk into your bedroom and hit a reset button. So how is that a big concern?
Yes and no. I'll start with the yeses. So the yes would be if you're using cellular backhaul, as you said, and you don't know how reliable that hardware is, that could be an issue. Similarly, if you haven't weatherized it well, or you know your cabling isn't good, and you might have to fix that frequently, or you know there was some horrible storm and you need to go, you know, make sure everything's okay. Basically, physical conditions, right? If physical conditions or backhaul are your concern, and you think you might need to access it for those reasons, yeah, that could be challenging. Okay. As far as the stability of the hotspot miner software and the hardware, it's been remarkably stable. The Helium hotspots are remarkably stable. The only reason I've ever had to reset one was because it lost its Wi-Fi connection because the host changed the password. You know, it's written in Erlang, all the miner software. And this is like a language in the OTP framework. I believe it was made for giant telecoms where nothing can go down ever.
Awesome. Okay.
It's pretty resilient.
It's like the network's in this early stage. Proof of coverage is number one way to collect rewards. But where do you see this going? I'm just curious, from the folks who think about it day in, day out, where's the LoRa headed? Like, who's going to be making the rewards from the data transfer aspect? What are the use cases of the data transfer? You know, I survey the landscape now. I look through the catalogs for the LoRa one. It's a lot of temperature transducers, environmental conditions, leak sensors. There's little tags that maybe you can hang on your dog and find the lost dog. But where's this space headed? I'm curious.
I think that's sort of like the big question. I think there's been a constant stream of partner announcements from Helium just today, I believe that, yeah, or yesterday. It was Airly, which is air quality tracking, which mm-hmm. is one of the sort of categories that you mentioned. But, you know, another interesting one that came online recently is Nobel Systems. And they're doing like huge parking lot deployments with like hundreds of spots per garage. So that's a really cool thing. But you know, these are only the partners that are announced, and it's a permissionless network. I know of at least one team building some cool stuff that I can't talk about. That's, you know, it's not announced and it's being done in stealth mode. And who knows how many other teams there are. Literally anyone can just spend $20 on a LoRa transmitter and start, you know, working on something. So I think it remains to be seen. But I think one important thing that we can say is that it doesn't just have to be LoRaWAN. I think that's going to be a really important thing going into the future, is
right.
that, you know, you can imagine a Wi-Fi, open Wi-Fi network being built on Helium. You can imagine 3G, 4G, 5G networks being built on Helium. And when I say built on Helium, I mean they're using the same underlying blockchain, and they're using data credits and possibly using proof of coverage. But the important thing is that all these protocols can live on one blockchain, and they can all drive value into the token together, which is a very interesting sort of phenomenon that could eventually happen. If you look through the My Devices store, you can just see the variety of different devices they sell. I mean, every type of sensor you can imagine that doesn't send like a massive amount of data is on there. Yeah, like everything that you would imagine has mostly been built, like in terms of sensors and whatnot. So that's kind of a good thing for the Helium network, that there are already all these compatible devices out there. You see new things coming out, like LoRa mousetraps, which is just awesome. It's like, you know, who wants to like, you know, check their mousetraps all the time? Like it's one of those like dumb first world conveniences that just makes me smile for some reason.
Yeah.
But you know, there's so many things. I think it's up to all of us to like imagine what a world with more data could look like, and also to make that a good future and not a scary future.
Yeah. I want to see the first LoRaWAN application to kind of go viral using the Helium network.
Yeah. I mean, I've thought up some pretty crazy ideas. I mean, you could do some really interesting here, free ideas for anyone who's looking to start businesses on top of the Helium network, but it'd be very cool for outdoor lighting displays. In Philadelphia, we have this thing called the Spruce Street Harbor Park. It's like my favorite place to go in the summer. And in the trees, they have these sort of like LED icicles, and they're just very cool. And they have hammocks under the trees. And I thought, how cool would it be if you could, you know, control the lights above your hammock and like set your color, or set your mood, or what if you could like pay a little bit of cryptocurrency, like $5 to like make the whole park radiate in some pattern, or like, you know, write your name in LEDs or something.
Right.
That's like a very fun sort of outdoor, like recreational type application. I also think it would be really cool to take an e-ink display and put it in a public place, like a cafe or something, and just make like really low fidelity advertising that could sort of like live on solar power, and just like text only advertising. That would be totally maintenance free. You put it up and you know, give the cafe there like $5-$10 a month and sell ad space. That'd be pretty cool. There are so many things. I really care about environmental stuff. I think it would be really cool to just monitor air quality, you know, throughout the globe, which I think is what Airlie is doing. So
yeah, the air quality has been especially important in California this season, right? And I everyone for like a month was just hammering these air quality sort of websites with these servers, and people needed that data, like extremely important data. And what if what if air quality node density went up by like one or two orders of magnitude, like the value you could bring to people. So Amazon's getting into the space. Is it clear at all what their end goals are? I know it's not the exact same protocol, but it's like, they'll basically be shipping some sort of low power chips to all of their hardware that you hang on your door or your camera or whatever. What's their end goal? I'm curious. Do you know? You have any insights
there?
We
are too. No, it's actually, I've researched this a lot, so I'm happy to share like my sort of take on it, because it was very opaque for a while. And I think we've gotten more details recently. So initially it was just a blog post. It was like introducing Amazon Sidewalk. It's the way to connect things near your house or in your house, and you can, you know, help your neighbors connect their stuff. It was so vague. But since then they've kind of had a launch, and basically the rundown is it's a service for connecting your devices in your home and your neighbor's devices. And there are two types of base stations for it. There's the Alexa and there's the Ring doorbell. I think the initial confusion had a lot to do with like, does this compete with Helium? And it both does and doesn't, for multiple reasons. So first of all, technologies used. It's mainly focused on Bluetooth low energy. Okay. And the reason for this is because you need low latency. You know, if you flip on your light switch, you don't want your LED light bulb to take 5 seconds, right? Which is what might happen in the LoRaWAN scenario. Like devices in LoRaWAN can't really transmit more than like 2 to 3 seconds. That's kind of pushing it due to the requirements with like transmit and receive windows. So Bluetooth low energy allows for like near, you know, sub 100 millisecond latency, I believe. So it's just a much better latency picture. There is LoRa technology also embedded in the devices, but it is not LoRaWAN. LoRa is sort of like one layer below LoRaWAN in the layers of abstraction. Not entirely clear what they're using that for, but it is in there. And so one really interesting blog post that came out a few days was, I believe it was Semtech and Amazon, or like LoRa Alliance and Amazon, basically relevant industry player in Amazon, came out and said that they're working with Amazon to make sure that LoRaWAN is what's used in Amazon Sidewalk, not just LoRa. And they basically said, we're in communications with the Sidewalk team. We understand that they didn't use LoRaWAN because it has shortcomings that made it not usable for them. And we are going to address those shortcomings, and we're going to release a new revision of LoRaWAN. And Amazon has said that when we do that, they will use it.
Oh.
So this is sort of an interesting thing for the Helium network, where eventually Amazon Sidewalk will be LoRaWAN compatible. I'm sure Bluetooth Low Energy will still be in there, but I don't know what they're trying to solve. Maybe they're trying to solve for latency. That would be a pretty interesting thing. If LoRaWAN could have a new revision that has much lower latency, maybe larger packet sizes.
Maybe they're, I'm just spitballing here on the Amazon side, reducing a lot of the friction in terms of the, installing cameras and doorbells and echoes and so on and so forth. So make it easier for the less tech savvy people. If there's a pervasive prevalent signal, maybe it helps the onboarding process.
Yeah, it certainly seems like that would be the case. I mean, if you just bought your little Amazon smart device and you're trying to hook up your, fish tank monitor or whatever, and you don't have an Echo at home, but your neighbor does, and they're 20 feet away and they can provide a signal for you to get that zero sort of zero setup experience. Like I think that's something that Amazon would want. They're all about reducing the friction to making you spend money with them. So
absolutely. Yeah.
It seems like that would be their goal. But Sidewalk is interesting. It's like an explicitly different goal than Helium, which is to create an open, permissionless, wide covering, low power network. And Amazon Sidewalk it's not explicitly, but I think you could say it's implicitly aimed at the suburbs, where you're creating radius of maybe tens of feet of coverage. Whereas, with a Helium hotspot, you might put it at the top of the hill and cover 10, 20 square miles. It's a different thing. It's a different type of network. You require Amazon's permission to connect to it. There's no incentive model, right? Like, there's no reason for people to move their Alexa out from little metal cages behind their toaster. And it's just interesting. I mean, Amazon scares me because, like, I keep thinking that they're like doing too much stuff and like will lose focus, but then they like somehow end up just being good at everything. And it's like really scary. But at the same time, I think if Amazon switches to the LoRaWAN protocol and they can increase the pervasiveness of LoRaWAN devices, if they're, let's say even if they get, 10 billion devices out there, if there's eventually the Amazon mass exodus, there will be the Helium network to, continue the life of those devices. So I think that's pretty interesting. It's going to be interesting to see it play out, but I think Helium has much more momentum and mindshare than Sidewalk in the circles that I run in. Certainly there's no crypto aspects at all to Sidewalk. So that's another sort of thing I think Helium has going for it.
So I'm curious, Armin, what's your occupation, your job? Are you full-time on Helium? Is this a side thing for you? What is your life like?
Yeah, Helium has become pretty front and center for me. I'm fortunate to have a pretty open lifestyle because of what I've done up until now, which is mainly app development. I have a game called Falcross, which is like a puzzle game, which I've been working on and off for years in between other projects. Before that, I co-founded a real estate property management startup called OneRent, which is still around. I've also built a lot of the systems for a food delivery startup called Habitat Logistics, which is based in Philly. And just, I've done a lot of apps you haven't heard of because they went nowhere, or, because I spent 3 months on them and Apple straight up rejected them. I think my biggest claim to fame is probably my game Slide to Unlock, which went viral. It went to number one in the App Store in 2012. But I've had a long app development career, and that sort of allowed me a lot of personal freedom. Although I will say there were multiple years in there that were like intense struggles to just like keep up with the bills and stuff like that. So it's not all sunshine and rainbows, but I've also been involved on and off in crypto since 2010, since Bitcoin was sort of just first becoming a thing. I've bought and sold and rebought Bitcoin so many times at this point. I'm not selling now. This is the time. It's the time to keep them. But no, like Ethereum, I was super interested in Ethereum in 2016 and 2015. And it just seemed like the next thing, right? Like Ethereum is just like, what if Bitcoin could do everything else that a normal application could do, which is just like, it was the coolest thing ever. And it still is. I got involved heavily in Nano. I built their Block Explorer, which I had sadly to shut down because it was too much to maintain. But just various crypto projects. Right now, I'm really focused on Helium. It's fortunately like, you know, building out the hotspots is like a good stream of income. So it's able to support me in like doing this podcast. I started this because people told me I was good at explaining things. And so here I am trying to simplify Helium for everybody. And, you know, I think if I can participate in the community and sort of absorb all the knowledge and sort of regurgitate it in a digestible way, which is like some really disgusting metaphor based around birds that I did not intend to make. If I can explain things simply to everyone so that we can all understand Helium better and build a better network, I think that benefits everybody. And so I'm really happy to like devote a lot of time to Helium, be super involved in the community. Helium is one of the most interesting projects I've ever seen. And I'm just waiting for that moment where a lot of other people start to agree very quickly. And you know, it sort of becomes the network. I've always been fascinated with the idea of creating decentralized networks that are not controlled by the telcos. Wi-Fi, yeah. When I was younger, that was a big thing. Like our city, Philadelphia, tried to create something called Wireless Philadelphia, which was just free Wi-Fi for all the residents. Unfortunately, it got shot down in a regulatory manner by Comcast. So they built out the whole Wi-Fi network, but it never got internet connection. And similarly, when I was going to college in Santa Clara, they had the city of San Jose had a free Wi-Fi initiative. And I don't know how that's going, but it was, you know, it was pretty garbage when I used it.
I don't think I've ever seen a really well executed free public Wi-Fi.
I think I've mentioned this on a previous episode, but my favorite public Wi-Fi network, which is totally a dark pattern, is Xfinity Wi-Fi. It's just like the most brilliant leverage of existing infrastructure, but in a malicious way. But it works so well. Like you can hardly go anywhere and pull up your phone's Wi-Fi without seeing Xfinity Wi-Fi. And that's just like some poor person broadcasting their own internet connection that they don't even know that's happening. But you know, if that can be so widespread, you know, why can't something that's actually honest and you know, voluntary like Helium with an actual reward, you know, be even bigger than that? I don't think there's really anyone who would disagree with the idea of Helium, that people should own the network. I mean, it's so common sense.
Harmon, this has been amazing.
This is a fun conversation. I like the angle that you're coming from. And what I want to see happen is for all the stops to be removed so that someone like you can like do all the experimentation you want, do all the deployment you want. And, you know, that's the goal we're all trying to get to. And I think, you know, talking about when the hockey stick happens, I think it's, you know, when smart minds can come together and just build this network and actually and use it. And when the supply limitation goes away, I think that's when we start hitting that beautiful territory.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope it can enable some more tinkerers listening to this, knock out some of the big conceptual questions, and then they can get down to building something.
Absolutely. Well, Steve, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah. My pleasure. Have a good weekend. Happy holidays. We'll be in touch.
Same to you. Take care.
Okay. See ya.